Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we'll be talking about some updates from the field. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at the new, most powerful tractor yet from Case IH. Ag History Minute, we'll talk the history of the quad track tractor. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueker, all with Tilth Agronomy. Fall seems to be coming in like a wrecking ball so far.
It's chilly this week.
Yeah, you get up every morning, it's like 40s.
It's awesome. But yes, you do need to, don't forget your sweatshirt. Or usually I just use my rain jacket when I do forget my sweatshirt.
Rain jackets work very well.
There's usually enough dew, you need your rain jacket anyway.
Right. And dew's been like hit or miss. Some have been really thick and then some just, they're always wet, so you always need it, but just some are heavy, and the next day it's just not as heavy. So it does seem like the humidity finally broke, too, that it's just kind of definitely feels like fall. Feels like fall weather, and Labor Day weekend ahead of us. You guys excited for that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the last weekend of summer, I guess. Kids are going back to school, and so they're different levels of excitement on that, I think.
Always different levels.
Very different levels.
Yeah, I get to see my friends, but I have to be in school all day.
But it'd be nice routine, back to the routine, doing the things that they should be doing. And
right.
You know, summer's good, but they need to get back into it again.
Yeah, it does seem like it gets harder and harder to get them back, like it back into that routine. I don't know if it's as they get older or as just the way things are now. Or yeah, summer is such a huge break for them that going back is like, yeah, just that much more.
Do you guys ramp your kids up like
the sleeping part? Yeah,
earlier this week.
Cause next try week, to, we yeah,
try to. Yeah, we try to, and then we fail.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Try to, and it doesn't seem to happen, and it doesn't seem to matter.
Right. I'll sleep like in.
The first day is going to be
just stay up. I can sleep in.
Yeah, the first day will be rough no matter what.
The first day maybe is okay because they're like nerves and all that. You know, they're a little more excited, and then by the end of the week, they're just.
For our kids, day number two is always like.
It's the worst.
It's the excitement of day one, right? We get, it's a new day. Yeah, but like Wednesday next week will be. So no one will want to get up. No one will want to go to bed. It's just, oh, crap. It's the newness of this. The new teachers and all that kind of routine is set in for a day. So,
what's my daughter, her teacher rolled up with her. So she's got the same.
Oh, nice.
Same teacher, even the same classroom.
We call it rolling up. I like that.
Yeah.
I like
your
that.
Wife's when teacher. I'm surprised you
I didn't know there was like a term for that. Yeah. Like, yeah, so basically move the grade up with her and
yeah,
do they keep all the looped, same I guess, kids or does she get to get rid of some of the kids she didn't like?
I think all the kids, as far as I know, had the option.
Okay. And ooh, that'd be a weird.
So it was kind of more on them than it was.
If you decided not to roll up with them, like they can stay in the grade below or no, I'm teasing.
They, yeah. They, some of them probably could.
Or should.
But yeah.
So she got to pick. So did she pick to stay with this teacher or?
Yeah, no, yeah. She liked her teacher. Yeah. She's good with it. There, I think most of the kids are there, maybe a handful that didn't.
Yeah. So. I feel like if you did it, it'd be a little weird. Like you'd have this, it would wear off quickly, but this sort of like.
You don't have to see him again, like, really, right. Other than in
well,
the hallway.
True, you're right.
It's not like you're, it's not like in middle and high school where you rotate
right,
around teachers and you're like, you would have that teacher for some class at some point, so.
So there won't be any newness then. It's the same.
Nope, same room, same.
Oh, it's the same room even?
Yep.
That's cool.
So.
I mean, open house, interesting probably. Like,
I am not looking forward to, so they basically merged the primary and intermediate centers back into one school. Like right, when we were in school, divide, it was one school.
Like first through, kindergarten through fifth grade. was one school, then they moved it into like two schools, like yep. you say, and now they're moving it back into
we're back
one school kind of.
Or now we got to do the stupid pickup patrol thing again.
That's which... why they're doing that. Okay, I didn't.
Yeah.
Okay. So enlighten me on pickup patrol.
It's some like web. It's not even an app. That's like the worst part. It's a website, and you gotta like if your kid's gonna be absent, or you're gonna pick up early or whatever, you're supposed to do it through this website, and you use it so infrequently that you have to like it'll log you out after a certain amount of time, so you go back and like
you have to relearn it every time you
like,
go
back in. And find your password and log in like and remember to do it on there. It sounds like it should be easier, and but it just doesn't seem to be. And then when you show up at school, whoever's picking up the kid's supposed to have, like, and I'm surprised they're still even trying this, but I felt like it wore off pretty fast. Was like a placard
thing, yeah,
in your card saying or saying who you're picking up or whatever, having the kid's name on it.
Like, you know, when the limo driver comes to meet you at the.
So you have to stand in front of your car and have.
But
oh, Mara, come to me.
You do have to check in with like the teacher, and then that's
is this end of day, or is this just
this is end
like,
of day? Yeah, so that's how they release
like when
them.
Everybody's leaving. That sounds crazy.
No, it's like I said. It's on paper. It probably sounds good. Like, oh, this is gonna be so much easier. You know, you don't have to call the office. You don't have to send a note, whatever. But it ends up not really being any easier.
I didn't even know that's the way we're supposed to be using it. Like if. If you were supposed to pick him up early for, like, a dentist appointment, you were supposed to go on this.
Because how much Todd has to deal with it.
I mean, that makes, we just email the I honestly, I never used it that way at all. So
it's in the instructions when you sign up for it.
Maybe he didn't sign up for it.
We didn't at all. We're going to have to, though, like Matt said, now, because it's moving.
So what if you have multiple kids that you want to pick up from the same school? Do you have to have one placard on each shoulder and be like, hey.
They did give you, multiple to, like, plaques. Stick in your windshield or whatever.
Seems like an expense for the school that's unnecessary.
Well, they're just printed on cardstock. I mean, it's not.
This isn't that big of a fancy. Yeah.
They're not like plastic. Not like a disability thing where you hang it from your rear view mirror and it's all plastic. And, it's.
So is it preventing someone from taking the wrong child?
That's the idea, I think. Is that
a problem?
And so they know who's supposed to be getting the kid and stuff, probably. But I don't know how many.
So we haven't had to use it now.
So then, if 2 years, mom goes and gets them, you have to make sure she gets the placards.
Right,
this is getting complicated.
Yes, exactly.
No,
it's like selling your Packer tickets. You got to mail them, or now you can at least just email them. To the
you don't print. You don't copy a bunch of placards that look.
We did the.
He's just stolen. You get a placard.
Who wants to pick up my kid today?
Made two copies, one for me, one for my wife, because my wife picks them up most of the time, or my mother will go pick them up sometimes. So made sure they both had one, and then I have one just in case. But and it seems like it slows down the end of the day thing too, because you got to check in with the teacher, and then they send your kid out. So it's like everybody's standing there in line, like, and of course it's never an actual line. Like, people are like running up to the teacher, like, to tell them that their kid's there because they want to get out of there. And I feel bad for those teachers that have to do it, or the aides or whoever. Because then they get to figure out, okay, did I talk to you? Did I talk to you?
Right.
Which is, the first week isn't bad, but I'm sure after, like, you know, you see the same people every day for how many days, you're like, crap, did I talk to you? Yeah, like, well, you're here. And that a couple of them were getting really good at, like, you wouldn't have to talk to them, they'd see you, and they'd just, like,
just not,
check it off and stuff, yeah. But
Right Sound is just a free-for-all.
And that's
you just
the way.
Stand out front of the front door, and kids pour out.
Yeah, and that's the way. Like once they were in third grade, it was that way.
Yep.
Oh, okay. So this is.
And now they decided to.
So this is all elementary now.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, it's still
all K through five now. All has is doing.
Because middle school, it's just, which who's going to steal a middle school kid? Nobody wants to deal with
it. No. Moody and hungry and.
And it's the. So when we went to one principal, it was the primary principal that he's now the whole building principal. That's oh, why it's
sure.
That's the driving force.
It's the one principal.
Yep.
Yeah, our middle school, it's like nobody cares. Like,
yeah, middle school, nobody cares. High school, nobody cares.
They could walk to the drugstore. We're all.
Do you have a truck store?
No.
Okay. Why do you choose trucks?
I'm just like random.
Okay.
Yeah, it's only elementary.
To the bar.
Yeah.
Like they can go to the bar. If they don't. Once they get in middle school, they don't need a note. They just walk out.
Cool.
Oh. In Seymour, you still need a note. Like if they're leaving.
Well, if you're leaving.
Not at the end of the day, but if.
Yeah, at the end of the day. I mean, like
oh,
when
yeah.
school's over, they just.
Yeah. If they're going to leave early, they have,
yeah.
they have no, they
yeah.
can't just leave.
Right. No. They do that yet.
But yeah, no, it's only the elementary school. I don't know. Apparently, this principal really likes that program.
Must, yeah.
Cause
I wonder if did they come from a district that did something of that nature?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Couldn't tell you. All right, you guys ready to get into our topic for today?
Yep.
So, Todd, what do you got for us?
Yeah, so just... bunch of stuff we're seeing out in the field, especially kind of the end of August here. Scouting just changes where you're scouting for less for this year, more for next year. But this year scouting seems like we're scouting still for this year, that there's enough disease pressure out there that you just want to keep an eye on and just stuff we're keeping an eye on. Nothing we're going to treat this year. Nothing. It's just
stuff. Not falling.
It is not falling.
You're not running out of the cornfield. Like,
it's not a panic. Yes, it's there. One thing to note too is as this weather breaks, we kind of talked about weather earlier, and as it breaks, yeah, diseases as well don't. Certain diseases, especially, don't like this weather. Other diseases might like it more, and you know, blow up. But certain diseases may not. So one thing seen in the corn right now is just sort of. Disease versus dry down, like who will win? Will disease kind of catch hold and dry down our corn, or will it go to actually maturity, physiological maturity? Will the corn plant be able to
yes
to win? Yes, is right. What I would say is I do think disease is going to be a factor, but in general, it's not going to be. I still think maturity for most fields is going to be what wins.
I feel like Todd was walking in some fields this week and he just saw the corn arm wrestling with the disease.
It was literally
who's going to take us down?
It was like a race to the top of the, like Southern Rust, you know, has been in the bottom of the canopy. It's a race to the top leaf.
Yeah.
Which is it Southern Rust going to make the top leaf first and kill it or will it die on its own?
At one field this last week that was very patchy.
They're
Southern
all,
Rust.
They're all patchy.
And but I mean like really, well, really bad.
The bad ones do see like spots. You'll find spots like the size of a four-wheeler or a truck where it's just like, holy man. And then it's like, okay, just walk out of this because you're going to get to a spot where it's.
Right. Yeah. You walk
pretty much one or two spots.
Couple rows yeah. over and you're.
And it's
completely
better.
Different.
Yeah, yeah. It's not necessarily zero, but. That is one part I think that's set in the panic is how intense these spots are of Southern Rust and how much it infects certain areas of the.
But yeah, this farmer was just one field that had real bad patches. I mean, I've found it in other fields, but that out of 250 acres of corn, there was one 40-acre field that had.
Maybe a good way to say too, like the susceptibility. Of plants to Southern Rust, the highly susceptible ones must have, like within, just have those spots that are really, really bad. Because I've got a few fields where I've got like a highly susceptible variety and it's stripped with like a less susceptible, and they both still have it. It's just you walk across and you can definitely tell the line, and then you walk in the one that's highly susceptible, and that's where your eyes just get real big. Like, ooh, no, okay, this is here, and it's going to be, you know, a potentially a problem for dry down. But so watching for Southern Rust, especially watching corn silage harvest window, not really as much tar spot, northern, other diseases. I do think as the weather gets, it's called Southern Rust for a reason. We talked about this last week, that it does prefer, you know, 80-plus degrees and high humidity. Since we've lost that, I think we'll see the... you know, the amount of the disease, it'll still be there, but it isn't going to sort of progress as quickly. And we might see more northern corn leaf blight actually sort of progress as we get this colder weather, cooler weather. And watch corn silage harvest window. I think it's potentially going to be shortening, trying to find out past data of like how much it would shorten. And it was very vague. You know, it said as much as like 3 weeks, which if it was shortened to 3 weeks, we'd be chopping now. So I don't think it's going to do that. But I do think it could cut off, you know, 2 to 5 days of where you expect to chop, and maybe go chop those fields a little earlier, or that variety that had it real bad a little earlier. So one thing to watch right now is just kind of picking which fields have it the worst and keeping an eye on those. The other thing to watch is for if you are harvesting for corn silage and it does have southern rust, there is some good data that shows you should probably be using a Buchneri type of inoculant. So just watching your inoculant on it, that mainly it seems like it messes with the pH in fermentation, so it doesn't get low enough. So adding that inoculant in really can help. And it did basically show that even on very high, maybe the more moderate ones, that for sure work. When you get real high, it definitely still helped, but maybe it couldn't overcome it as much. But for sure, the pressure we're seeing, adding the right inoculant to your silage is going to help a lot. So make sure you're talking to your inoculant salesman right now, kind of getting that lined up, because that is going to be important this year because of all the disease pressure we have. So, I mean, July was a greenhouse this year, guys. It was like we had everything.
What do you mean?
Yeah. And we kind of knew it was coming. I think southern, I mean, if we checked the tape, I think I went back and said, I don't think it's going to be tar spot this year, because we just didn't, it was going to be something else. And I thought northern, which looking back is almost laughable, because it was like, why if we're that warm with north, you know, being that hot. And it was just a greenhouse. So we're going to have disease throughout the Midwest. You're reading articles about that, of seeing rust on combines as guys are getting started.
And now we're starting to dent in some areas too.
Right.
You know, so the impact, we talked last week or whenever about southern rust, the impact of any treatment now is...
Yeah, we're beyond that.
We're beyond
way,
that.
Way beyond that.
We're not going to treat. I mean, it sucks. It's out there, but just what, like you said, Todd, the last 2 minutes talking about harvest is really, we want to watch for any fields that just get out of control and maybe dry down faster.
Yeah.
And any disease is going to do that, right? We've seen northern
our spot. Our spot does
our
that.
Our spot, too. Right?
One other thing with the corn silage harvest is we planted all in a very tight window, fairly tight, not necessarily everybody, but then it did get cold in June, and that tends to kind of maybe put that starting line fairly equal for varieties as well. So we really have a crop that's ready in a really tight window already, meaning for your custom harvest guys, if you chop your own, I think it'll be fine. But if you're thinking there's going to be a window of, you know, 3 weeks to 4 weeks within a region where you're used to, and you work with a custom harvester, it's going to be very difficult. Either they're going to come too early or probably too late, and there's going to be, you know, say one of their clients that gets spot on. So talking to your custom harvester, you know, hopefully you do have sort of different day lengths, or you maybe planted at a different time than the other people that they harvest for. But I think we are already going to have like a shortened window, and then throwing southern rust in there is even going to more so make that window not necessarily... The window will be the same width, it's just the back end might all of a sudden fall off on us and it dry down quicker. So just something to really watch.
And just remember, even though you may have treated, you know, what, a month ago for fungicide, still be looking at those fields, because pretty much every field that I've treated still has some level of rust in it. It might be well low in the canopy and it may never make its way up, but it's still there.
Correct. I think that's a good point, Bill. Early on, we did see it helped, but it wasn't necessarily mean you have zero disease,
right?
And your neighbor that didn't treat has a full disease. Then moving on to corn grain, I do think this is going to be a year that you don't want to leave your corn out past Halloween. That is,
well, as Jeff Frank said, yes. Nothing good happens in a cornfield after November.
I think it was after October, right? In November. Which is just the best saying ever, because I think we're going to have, you know, mainly we've been talking about leaf diseases, but we're going to have stalk rots. We're going to have other issues with just standability in general, potentially, that on a normal year we have, where this year it's just going to be exacerbated. So just be watching that we don't really want to leave any fields out there, you know, especially in December, and the quicker you can around Halloween be harvesting grain, I think the better.
Get her done.
And then just wondering what you guys are seeing for cobs overall. In general, we're seeing good cobs, and just a really consistent, like, 16 by 33 seems to be, like, when I was averaging my cob numbers, was a very consistent cob size we were getting. You know, just it varied, obviously, and it did tend towards the shorter, or excuse me, not as girthy cobs. But when I ran it against my last year's numbers, it actually showed they were more girthy this year. So it felt like maybe a thinner cob.
I would say I haven't seen any 12s. I've seen some 14s, but I've seen 20s and 22s.
Yes.
So it's not, definitely not a, and but no, and a lot of that can be varietal, but I haven't seen any real super long cobs. Like a 38 is probably the biggest.
Yeah, we've had a few like in the 40s, but nothing huge that way. I would agree, nothing where you hold up to your forearm and you get real excited. You know, it just looks huge. And maybe that goes to show our populations this year are adequate and we have the plants in the ear count we need out there. Because that's one thing that's not talked to. I mean, yeah, you can get a giant ear if your population is a little too low.
I don't feel like the presence, though, of the 20s and 22s is as high as other years.
Correct.
I feel like we have, there are out there, but it seems like your eights had like 16s, a pretty 18 maybe, but.
Yeah, enough 14s to kind of counteract the 18s. We did have a few silage varieties this year that got like 10s and 12s, but it was a variety thing.
I would say,
and it was weird. Like a 10 was almost just looked weird because it actually looked.
Remember the last time I saw a 10?
No, and it looked like a 16.
Sure.
Like if when you grabbed it and you opened it, like what is happening?
It's
like
a big deep kernel.
Kernels are huge. Yeah. So I do think that part of this year, the and I'm not sure like what the Pro Farmer Crop Tour uses as their number to of dividing how much bushels. You know, there's this you should use between 70,000 and 120,000 number to get your bushels per acre, and this year probably is one we're going to be a deeper kernel potentially. That, in you know, typically 90,000 is kind of the norm. That maybe you bump it to 85,000 to try to compensate for that. But
we had that rainstorm, 10, 12 days ago. I think that helped, but I am seeing, and I got a cob in my hand, a little bit of nose.
Yeah, I've seen some nose back.
Nose back a little bit than maybe normal, just from that dry stretch we had. So it was good we got that rain because it'd be really bad now, and it sounds like we're due for a little bit here, so hopefully that'll help.
Yeah, that rain was interesting timing, too, because I know farmers say, like, whoa, we should be good. We don't need any more rain, and then we went through that stretch where we did need a little
bit. And if we wouldn't have got that, we'd still be waiting.
We'd be, right. Yeah. We'd be.
We needed the rain. We just, it wasn't consistent enough. There's places south of here and west of here that didn't get rain in those time periods, and there you can tell that how close to drying out they were, because there's some, you get down towards like Princeton area, there's some pretty dry looking fields down there.
Mm-hmm. I do think throughout the Midwest we are going to have some of that, not necessarily droughts, not necessarily, you know, what you'd consider a heavy drought, but just that they had a 2-week period of that sort of flash drought that was able to kind of set in. We were that hot in that period too,
right,
that it did affect it. But yeah, overall, like, cobs look good. Corn looks good. I mean, it's not necessarily our best crop ever. It's looking like as far as, you know, nationwide, we are going to yield our best yield ever, but we're also ahead on acres too. But it is going to be sort of a good crop out there. One of the hard parts, I think, is the, with the low prices, the mentality is let's yield our way out of that. And this year I do feel is going to be tough to do that. I mean, you're going to have some fields that yield really well, but you're going to have some fields that are probably pretty much normal and maybe slightly disappointing because, but they're normal. You got to remember what normal is. So
what is normal? Please.
Well, we don't know that. You're right. We don't know that anymore.
Nope. Gone.
So moving into soybeans, kind of just hanging in there, and man, for the tough start they had, they looked really tough early this summer, and you went, how are they ever going to, you know, what are they really going to do? How are they going to end up? And as far as late summer goes, they've done well. They were just so slow early, and then they kind of came on at the right time, which is good. And one of the things to think about with them is we didn't have, like, there's disease there. There's frog eye leaf spot, you know, where it's sudden death syndrome here and there, soybean cyst nematode. I don't see that one hasn't necessarily shown its face yet in enough beans, really, but we know it's kind of down there. And then fields with history with the white mold are going to be tough. So, I mean, you're going to have some of that disease hitting you. But as far as, like, bug pressure goes, there wasn't really much of any at all. I mean, maybe a little Japanese beetle here and there.
Yeah, Japanese beetles were probably the most prevalent, and a little bit of aphid here and there, yeah. But not much. Yeah, though, the beans, the lodging beans seem to get the white mold bad. Well, I shouldn't even say bad. Get white mold. I've got a couple fields with white mold that they really haven't gotten real, real bad yet. I mean, and they're far enough along that hopefully they won't.
That's good news, because if you're seeing it now, usually then it's like the wheels fell off. But if you haven't seen it from the road yet, where it's that oof, you know, then right. It's like, okay, it can,
yeah, where you can tell, oh yeah, it's got it out there, you know,
yeah, hopefully this plant can kind of push through that infection. And then I think one big wild card on the beans is just the wildfire smoke effects. I feel like we just never know. And I do feel like that's always an excuse at the end of the year.
It's either way. It's right. Either an excuse or right. It's, oh, yeah, that was the best thing
that
ever.
That actually helped, yeah. But so far, looking it up, the Midwest actually has had more air quality alerts in 2025 than in 2024.
I think we had more prolonged periods of it, too. Where right. It was consistently every day.
And looking back to 2024, the real bad ones were actually in kind of early in May. And then I think a few ones came like real late. But this year it was right in that window of photosynthesis for beans where, you know, in June and July. So I think that might, as far as what yields going, I always have our, looking at beans to me, yes, you could count pods. You can look at how many there's in the area, but it's amazing to me how hard it is to peg bean yields. Cause to me right now, they all look like sort of 50, 60 bushel beans. They're nothing. They don't look super special, but they don't look bad either right now. So it'll be interesting how they look. And you can actually start to see some of those early day beans starting to turn out there.
Yeah, there's patches
of
turning beans.
So yes, if you think you have like sudden death syndrome now, and look at your maturity, it probably is just starting maturity. To turn. Which is good, too, as we turn the page into September, you know, the beans, you know, are going to start, we want them to start to get ready here. Anything else you guys seen in the beans? It just feels like
they're just like cruise control. Like
kind of.
And kind of hanging out, starting to fill pods now. You know, there's nothing just there.
I'd hope they surprise us because they look good. And again, they came on at the right time and we had the right weather for them. And in general, the beans this year are thinner in general, which I think has helped them with the white mold pressure.
Right. Had some guys talk about, there's a deer walking through my bean field. And then all of a sudden I couldn't see it anymore. The beans were so tall.
They're getting tall though too. Right.
Yeah. Well, that's where the lodging issues coming in with some fields and I have one field of 30s that canopy till probably like a week and a half ago.
Okay.
I mean, it just didn't, it was later planted. It just didn't close out. Most of the other ones did. But yeah, even between 15s and 30s, like it seems like they're both tall. They're both getting where they need to be.
And I don't, if they're super late, but if just a little late planted, do those beans look okay?
Oh yeah.
Cause yeah, the one thing to note for this year has been that early plant beans, early, what we'd call that kind of the new wave of early beans, really was not very successful this year.
No.
In general, kind of planting what I'd call on time worked well. And then even, you know, maybe if you're 2 weeks or 3 weeks late, if you'd call it that, those look quite good too.
And if you remember, the late planted beans last year looked awful.
Yes.
And they yielded awful.
Yes. So it was this sort of flip. That was the thing, is then everybody's, well, I want to plant early this year and go earlier. And it just didn't, the weather didn't work for that.
With those really early beans, it'd be interesting to see how the fields senesce, just because we had such delayed emergence in spots of those fields.
Yep.
And so you might have these patches of green throughout in a field that looks ready other than, you know, a few sections.
Just over the last 3 weeks, the amount of water hemp we talked before, but just the amount of water hemp that's decided to poke its head out. And
yeah.
And even, I think I called Utah about a field, and we had sprayed it a little bit later, and we had gotten the main stem of the water hemp, but then everything poking through now is basically an offshoot of the plant, because we didn't get the whole plant. We didn't kill every growing point. So it's like almost like an upside down umbrella where the top is dead, but then below where we killed is where the new shoots came, and those are a foot above the canopy. And it's like, oh man,
I've been doing a lot of thinking on that, Bill, as I'm walking beans, because especially now it's like, well, what do we do going ahead? And like a couple weeks ago, driving through Indiana, Illinois, and even a little before that through Minnesota and other states, and in general, like, we have a problem in Wisconsin more so than I saw it anywhere else.
Agreed.
So that is sort of you start looking at that, and then hearing from a friend that visited the area too, like, holy man, why do you guys suck at controlling water? You know, it just, we have more peak in their heads than others. Not that other places are perfect, but it's very spotty. But I would say in Wisconsin, we weren't able. And one of the things, looking back at my scouting notes, was that cooler June. And like we just said, how slow they came. They didn't.
They weren't emerging very fast.
They didn't emerge fast. Then our sort of basically our second pass of herbicide, even with the residual, with or without, I actually don't have many like fields that are with it that look that they look slightly better. I would maybe say that, but that second pass, it seemed like we have to do it at a time that the beans were staging out at, you know, are starting to flower and be reproductive beans, but they were so small yet at the time. They weren't even like you just said, Matt, you just had some 30-inch row beans just canopy.
Right.
And at that time, we didn't canopy till July, you know, it was like mid-July almost before, even late July. So
right.
It just didn't canopy. So I think that left open a lot, not necessarily like new ones growing, but that the ones we were able to burn back still were getting enough sunlight, and they weren't sort of overtaken by this big robust bean around it. So Bill, what do you think driving, you know, through areas and seeing maybe why they were successful or not?
I've talked about that because we had a couple of farmers go to Pontiac with the precision planting, must have had a field day, and the farmer made their comment to the guy that was driving, like, why don't we, you know, they were in Illinois, why don't we see the water hemp here? And I've been around enough this summer looking at other states too and seen the same thing. And the guy driving was like, well, we're just driving too fast. We can't see
can't
it.
But
I agree. It's like, I still think we have a problem in this area. Maybe it's just this area too, but I still think we're trying to kill water hemp that's too tall.
Too big. Yep.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that.
One, the same farmer talking about this, driving too fast. We had two fields on his farm. One is clean of water hemp for the most part. The other field is not. And we've been racking our brains all summer long about it. And the only thing we can come up with is he was gone on a fishing trip, and then he came back, and he was going to spray his beans the second time when he came back. While he was gone, I was scouting those bean fields, and the field that has water hemp today, the water hemp was about 3 to 4 inches taller at the time of application when he got back from vacation than the field that's cleaner. So that's the only thing we can say is just that one field had water hemp taller than the rest of them, and those, the rest of them are clean, and this one is not. And I just, again, I think there's too much. When we're doing that second pass, whether it's Liberty or Enlist or whatever, there's too much beans.
Yeah, timing's important.
Covering that, those little
the bottom
growing points of those water hemp plants.
Right, and when they're that big, there's just that many growing points to kill.
20-some or whatever it is. Yeah. It's a lot.
One thing this year, the week we were supposed to spray, it rained.
Yeah.
So that just makes it harder, too. It's not necessarily fully in our control always to do that.
Is there a way that we can just never see them? Like, right. let's just keep the chemistry there so that we never have to worry about, and I don't even know if that's possible. You know, like, we don't have to worry about Liberty or Enlist because our residuals keeping them down enough that they're not a problem.
Yeah, I mean, they can basically still, new ones can come. Not that we're seeing all new ones, like we said, but can come into August. So, I mean, if you're not canopied and you have open ground, you're getting sunlight, you could have them emerge in August. And to get your residual to carry through to August, if you're planting even in early May and putting your first batch of residual, you're running out of residual in July somewhere. Like, you're
just I'd argue, Matt, too, that they're germinating even under the canopy.
Right.
After canopy closure, they're still coming.
They're still there, yeah. Because, yeah, the fields that looked clean all of a sudden had that little poke.
Yep.
But, yeah, timing was hard to get this year, and it was, you know, I know one farm I was told them to spray, like, 2 weeks in a row. It was like, nope, yeah, you didn't get it done. You need to get it done now, like, and rain or whatever got it in the way. And
is it the dairy thing? Like, some of these guys just don't have, like, that's milk cows spray their own. I know that's less and less every year because we custom apply more and there's more custom guys out there. But is some of it just we have more diverse things to do in the state versus the I states?
Beans, too, used to be easy to spray. All of it was easy. It was cheap and easy.
Right. Roundup.
Yeah, and now it is, like, flipped to be the opposite. It is very hard to spray, is not cheap, and I think that timing, even that window, is that much more critical that it just makes it hard. It's just very hard.
Well, and we did talk, if you remember, rewind the tape back in May, that, like, this was one of the windiest
right
springs in the last 50 years,
right.
So maybe some of that's that, too, where guys should have been out spraying, but they couldn't because it was too windy. Or like you said, Todd, it was starting to rain. So just environmental factors we can't control.
Have you seen a better guys that went a pre-emerge versus like an early post? Have you seen a difference there that you've...
I got one farm that has about 2,000 acres, and like, we do early post.
Sorry, still two pass. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but we do...
One is done pre versus going one at
that farm. We have really good water hemp control.
That when
we always don't have the best beans because they don't have the greatest drainage, so they always don't canopy. But this year we went, you know, after we went with Prefix after, and then come back with Perpetuo, and those are some of the cleanest fields I have.
Did you say that is Prefix on some of mine? Because that'd be Fomasafen. So you've got a burner in there, that Flexstar, that's going to burn with Dual. And those, for me this year, because the beans were so slow, that it seemed like the Flexstar actually, And these were up pretty good. You know, we let them so that they weren't like just coming out because it can really burn them. But they were up probably 4 to 6 inches, and they just sat there for like two weeks.
Yeah. But at that point, if there is any early water hemp
right.
that's there, it's going to be seedlings.
And the Flexstar gets them, which right. is nice. Right. Whereas some of our controls that way, like I had actually one where we did Perpetuo early, which is Zidua with Resolve. So you could kind of your Zidua premixes, but go early post with them. And if you have any there, they're not going to get them.
No.
So then it's, you sort of got to watch that a little bit. Yeah. One thing, to be honest, I didn't notice a huge difference. And one reason I think it is when we're going pre with the herbicide, we can usually go a little bit more herbicide, just sheer amount of herbicide,
yep.
and different modes of action. And then we switch to post, it's some sort of group 15, and it's a lot less. So yes, you applied maybe 2 to 4 weeks later, but you're putting less herbicide on, so they end up almost similar by the end. So I don't know yet which is... one thing I'm considering is trying to maybe even bump up that Liberty or the Enlist, instead of combining them ever in the second pass, is using one of those in that early post pass and then switch into the other one, like the later post. But anyway, yeah, it feels like every year we learn a little, but at the same time, it's still very, you know, what worked in one field didn't work in the next field. So then there's no sort of consensus among us as agronomists of like what was good or bad. So, all right, last thing, we'll wrap this one up quick, was alfalfa. And this one even, so we went with kind of like, this one seemed to be very little drama. We didn't have to spray for leafhopper.
Other than first crop wasn't as good as we expected.
Quality.
Yield wasn't.
Good point.
Every crop's been better.
But
second and third were better than first.
Yes. So that is a good point, man. His first is like, well, what the heck? Like, this should be huge. And it'll be interesting what Jarek's
yield and persistence project
shows, what Ag Agent Kevin Jarek's sort of data shows on that, because it doesn't feel like it's going to be the 40% like we're sort of used to, if you want to call it.
I even heard a story of a Lazarus hayfield this year
where it looked,
they thought it was dead and put triticale into it, went to cut the triticale, and the hay was all underneath again.
Sure.
So then they kept it a hayfield and got more cuttings off of it. So, yeah, it was weird start year for a lot of things.
Yes.
That alfalfa especially and, you know, Kevin was on and talked about some of the factors, you know, how the buds get set the fall before. And so with the cold weather, if all those buds get frozen off, it has to restart in the spring. And that seemed to show through in a lot of the first crop.
So, yeah, in general, though, at least.
Bug-wise, there was.
And yield-wise, in general, guys are, you know, last year was okay yielding. Well, high yielding, but low quality. So I think that is, you know, this year it was just probably fairly normal yielding, but it's going to be enough to fill what we needed. So that's good.
Yeah. All right, there you go. There's a look at what's going on out in the field. Now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So if you're headed down to the Decatur Farm Show this week, you could have took a look at the most powerful tractor yet from Case IH. The Steiger 785 Quad Track is their new tractor, with peak 853 horsepower output. The Steiger 785 Quad Track is the new flagship workhorse. We understand the demands of farming are only increasing. The Steiger 785 Quad Track is a workhorse designed to meet those demands with power and productivity, according to Ken Lehman, customer segmentation lead at Case IH. With long days in the field, the boost in horsepower and torque allows farmers to do more in a day. So with the increasing power, Case IH engineers didn't sacrifice agility or comfort. Brand representatives advertise the 785 as having excellent visibility and maneuverability with superior operator experience and cab comfort, according to the spec sheet on the new machine. Meanwhile, an SCR-only emission system streamlines the engine's design. Emissions are treated after the engine system. By prioritizing simplicity, the machine can focus its efforts on power production. With the added horsepower, the tractor can pull larger implements faster via a 40% torque increase. An optional heavy-duty suspended undercarriage delivers a smoother ride, superior traction and flotation, and helps minimize soil compaction in the field. Inside the cab, the new 785 features subscription-free integrated precision technology that underpins automation-driven features, including Case IH's AccuTurn Pro and AccuSync systems, and data collected via telematics through Field Ops. So the new quad track is out there, and if you were at the farm show, you could have got a nice little tour of one and maybe even ordered a model for your farm. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So we'll talk a little bit about the history of the quad track tractor. Case IH developed in partnership with Goodyear, to research track systems for agriculture, which led to the articulated four-track design. The prototype was first publicly shown the Farm Progress Show in 1992, drawing an enthusiastic response from farmers that got to drive the quad track. In 1996, Case IH launched the first Steiger quad track models. The original lineup included two models, while today's product line includes seven Steiger quad tracks, plus the Steiger Rotrak and Magnum Rotrak models. The original patents protecting Case IH's quad track design expired in late 2013, about 17 years after the first production model was introduced in 1996. Expiration of these patents opened the door for other manufacturers to develop and market their own four-track articulated tractors. It also spurred Case IH to continue innovating and improving their quad-track line to maintain market leadership. The quad-track design, with its four independent oscillating rubber tracks, offers distinct advantages over traditional wheeled or dual-track designs, and the original patents gave Case IH a near monopoly on the technology for almost two decades. And those are some big tractors.
Do you think the quad tracks are cool? The wild part is still like how, so when they were doing a lot of the testing for it, they actually tested it in secret at night. So they would drive this thing in secret, and like Goodyear, you know, got the tracks and all that and put it on. It was working with another company, but they tested in like complete secret, which is just interesting to me that they were, yeah, trying to, you know, in the dark of night, driving it around. It says in brush fields mainly. And then in the 92 farm show, it had to be cool to see it. So they built like a soil pit, and it was dug down, and then there was like a shed over it. And during the show, basically, they would drive it out of this shed here and there. So they would like...
They would hide it away.
Hide it kind of away, and then, like, yeah, like the first day of
demonstrations
the show.
Or whatever.
Right. Yeah. So drive it out. So it was, like, just kind of a cool rollout of stuff that in its day, too, that was huge. You know, you're just like, holy man, that's a massive tractor. All right. Sorry, I was getting excited there, man. Thank you, Matt. Thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's very easy. Just search Tilt Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts. Or on your Android phone, download an app like Podcast Addict. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcast. And you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll move into our Cool Beans, That's Corny with some current events. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week, 71% of U.S. corn and 69% of U.S. soybeans are good to excellent. So there's not a lot of change in the national crop ratings over the last week or so. The USDA says 71% of U.S. corn is good to excellent, which is unchanged, with 83% at the dough making stage 44% dented and 7% mature, all close to the five-year average. 69% of soybeans are in good to excellent shape as of Sunday, with 1% higher change there, and 89% are at the pod setting stage, and 4% are dropping leaves, which matches the usual pace. 98% of winter wheat is harvested, which is in line with average. 49% of spring wheat is called good to excellent, 1% lower from last week, and 53% harvested, which is just a little bit behind normal. And for our southern friends, 54% of cotton is rated good to excellent, down 1%, with 81% of the crop setting bowls, looked like boils for a second, I was like, yeah, hopefully I've heard of a cotton boil, set in bowls, and 20% of bowls opening. So, be lots of cotton commercials being filmed in the next couple weeks here. But yeah, good news there for condition of the crop. Our That's Corny this week is farmers are urged to brace for a cash flow crunch in 2026. So a vice president of agribusiness banking says many producers are facing difficult decisions due to ongoing uncertainty in the economy. Cash flows could be challenging coming into 2026. Barry Benson with First National Bank of Omaha says many farmers are operating at or below their break-even costs. We've been telling producers to be very mindful and protect the balance sheet, and be diligent in their spending and control as many costs as they can. The latest supply and demand report from USDA forecasted larger corn and soybean crops, and Benson says producers need to be proactive marketing their grain. He said, I anticipate that a lot of grain this fall will be maintained on the farm at that kind of production levels. It will take about all the bin space that we have in an effort for higher prices, but just because they are low today doesn't mean they can't go lower. He also said that interest rates have been high, but a rate cut is expected in September. The 25 basis point reduction is sure to step in the is sure a step in the right direction as far as helping customers save a little interest expense. By no means will it bring corn and soybean prices back to the black if they're in the red. Said there's also been a decrease in loans for new and used ag equipment, which isn't uncommon due to concerns about cash flow. All right, and then to wrap things up this week, our Field Good Friday, we've got the Adopt a Cow program bringing dairy education home. So a cuddly cow has helped expand agriculture education, created in Pennsylvania nearly 2 million students across the U.S. this year. Brittany Snyder with the Dairy Excellence Foundation credits virtual learning during pandemic for its growth. It went viral with about 1,000 classes to 70,000 classes literally overnight in their program. The Adopt-A-Cow program started as a way to connect classrooms regularly with dairy farms virtually. So the teachers came in the surveys and said, love to take home piece of this. Can you create something? And so they went from a no option like that to 5,000 to 6,000 classes around the country getting a cow kit. And then plenty of teachers will get their own and do something similar. So up to 40 partner farms select dairy calves in September to be followed throughout the school year. They feel like they're helping take care of the cow, even though this is, in this case of the kit, they send a stuffed animal. So the growth has been very inspiring to see. People will send home little backpacks with them, and they'll publish a book about all the letters and writings they did throughout the year. Farmers that are in the program absolutely love the engagement and getting the finished books. Said about 3/4 of participants are K through 8th grade classrooms, but libraries and other partners are also participating. Nearly all state and regional dairy checkoffs support the program, and Snyder says one day they hope to reach 10 million students or more. So there you go. That's be it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
This week we talked about some corn, soybean, and alfalfa updates. Our spotlight, we looked at Case IH's new most powerful tractor, the new quad track. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of the quad track tractor. Cool beans this week. Corn and soybeans relatively unchanged in condition this week. Our That's Corny was bracing for cash flow issues in 2026. And our Feel Good Friday was the Adopt a Cow program bringing dairy education home. So thanks for listening. As always, happy farming.